Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Bobby Schmidt, Carlyle's co-head of global healthcare, to take a broader look at the healthcare sector and today's market environment, particularly the outlook for exits in private markets, given his recent experience with the Medline IPO, which is both the largest healthcare IPO and the largest sponsored IPO in history. This episode was recorded on February 13th, 2026, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before turning to Bobby, a word about what we're seeing in the portfolio and the outlook for the Fed. First, I would say that the January data were very strong in the United States. We saw real final demand growth in excess of 3%. That's up about 50 basis points from where a composite was tracking at the end of September. We also saw that there were signs of acceleration in about 57% of the time series we track, signs of deceleration only about 10%. So again, reasonable to think February may even be stronger once those data are collected. I think it's clear that the tariff shock has more or less been absorbed. As we've discussed in prior months, I think most management teams, once the initial tariff schedule was canceled, moderated, they treated this more or less as an unwanted foreign exchange rate fluctuation. You know, that's essentially what a 10 to 15% tariff rate amounts to. And it was interesting in January that we did not see any really follow-on effects on goods price inflation. So I think most of the adjustment has come through. And we also saw some strength in the industrial sector. That was not just in the United States, but globally, notably Germany, which has been struggling, of course, for a number of years. So that was very upbeat data. And I think it also supports some of the rotation we've seen in markets away from technology to real economy sectors. Secondly, we do see signs that the need for corporate management teams to come up with AI strategies has really empowered IT departments. IT budgets look to be growing at about a 30% annual rate. We have not seen growth like that at any prior point. And I think a lot of this is just the sense that there's been a need to make investments that could have been made in the past related to data capture, data storage, data analytics. But it's also a lot of work on workflows, integrating AI, availing themselves of the latest tools. So I think that that's very encouraging. We've also seen, of course, continued strength in order books related to AI data centers. The hyperscalers announcing their earnings, it looks as though total spending, when you account their outlays, where it's directed into the United States and the rest of the sector, other market participants, that AI CapEx is going to add 1 to 1.25% to U.S. GDP in 2026. That's not a projection. That is just, you know, actual spending intentions, and then based again on current order books, backlogs, etc. I would say that inflation, interestingly, even as goods inflation seemed to have moderated, that we did see a pickup in services inflation. And this perhaps is related to some of the immigration enforcement. Many of the services sectors are very labor intensive, therefore wage rates have an outsized role in the inflation rate that is observed. So the other big development, of course, in the month since we last spoke was the announcement that Kevin Warsh has been designated as the new chair of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. He's expected to take that seat in May pending confirmation. Of course, the president would like interest rates to be much lower than they are. He's been very clear on that. And of course, there's widespread expectation that Kevin Warsh is going to be under enormous pressure to deliver lower rates. He was starting, presumably his first meeting as chair of the FOMC will be June of this year. And I think a lot of people are wondering, you know, how is it in an economy that may be booming at that time? Certainly current trend lines would suggest that. With inflation that's kind of stubbornly remains above 3%. Again, a lot of change in the contributions to inflation, but you know, that's generally where we are. In that sort of environment, how can Kevin Warsh possibly deliver a series of rate cuts, not just one, but a series of rate cuts similar to what we saw in 2024 and 2025. I think the answer to that, very simply, is to talk about AI. We live in an information space today where we're just totally inundated with AI news on a daily basis. And of course, there's a very strong presumption that AI is going to deliver a massive disinflationary shock to the economy, reducing demand for labor, substantially increasing business efficiencies, and leading to a substantial and sustained acceleration in labor productivity growth. I think that that presumption, again, not really reflected in the data as yet, where inflation remains kind of sticky, but it's very widely held, very widely expected. And in some ways, the environment kind of reminds me of 2002. And what I mean by that is the presumption that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. There was never the government case to saying that we have definitive proof that this is the case. We're, you know, just suggesting it's more likely to be the case. But I think the locution that everyone remembers, the statement that had such an effect at the time by National Security Advisor Rice, suggesting that we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud, essentially accomplished two very important points. Number one, saying there is no smoking gun. But number two, suggesting that now is not the time, given what happened the prior year, for really high or exacting evidentiary standards. And I think that that kind of argument in this case, as relates to rate cuts in the face of this technological revolution, could really carry a lot of weight. You know, that we know what's coming. We see how dramatic the changes could be. We saw the added plugins to Cowork, just all the technical advancements. We see really on a daily basis, there's layoff announcements that cite AI. We see, of course, the other developments that are occurring where you have domain-specific applications that lead to, you know, dramatic volatility in markets for software, tax preparation, some money management, social media stories. I think each of these, in their own way, create a predicate for rate cuts. And so I think that we're starting to see, and we'll see very clearly by the middle of this year, is just a very sustained information campaign that if we wait for the full effect of AI to be reflected in the data, it may be too late. The economy may already find itself in some sort of deflationary spiral. So again, this is really an analysis of the argument or the discourse. It could be, given the CapEx budgets and spending, that real rates actually should be higher today than they are. But I think that this actually sets up very well for a new chair who, you know, may be determined to deliver three cuts, we'll say, between June and November of this year. And if that happens, I think it's going to be a pretty exciting time in markets, and certainly exciting for private equity exits, given the sort of upward pressure on valuations that may be exerted as a result of, say, base rates below 3%. And that's, I think, the perfect time to turn to Bobby. Thank you so much for coming on.
Great, Jason. Well, thanks for having me today.
And so I do want to talk about the exit of Medline, just given how historic it was. You know, I just want to talk about the healthcare sector more generally. In preparation for our talk, I did spend some time going through the national health expenditures from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And so right now at Carlisle, you look after about 18% of the economy, which is health expenditures, growing to over 20%. This was, of course, just 12% of GDP in 1990. So should we expect that eventually you'll be looking over a sector that accounts for the entirety of U.S. GDP?
Hopefully, for no one's sake, that's the case, Jason. But I think, as you're noting, you know, healthcare remains a very important part of the U.S. economy, but frankly, you know, the global economy as well. You know, it's $5 trillion in the U.S., and it's growing about 5% annually. But it's also highly diversified, you know, across services, life sciences, med tech, healthcare IT. So it's actually quite dynamic market rather than one holistic thing. And as mentioned, you know, the healthcare market, when you think about that globally, it's twice that size, $10 trillion. And it still grows in the mid-single digits. And here at Carlisle, you know, we think about healthcare on a global basis. As I sit here as an investor, you know, I think of this sector as a great place to spend our time. There's so many trends that you can follow. And in my view, you know, these trends are quite durable. You know, they might be demographic growth trends where clearly that we have an aging population in this country and in many others around the world. It's also driven by scientific innovation, you know, discovery of new pharmaceuticals that cure diseases or medical procedures that extend lives. And the U.S. has been long leaders in this innovation, which has driven our sector. And I always say that, you know, healthcare happens to be maybe a decade behind other parts of our economy in terms of technology adoption. You know, we have a long way to go on digital transformation, you know, with technologies that have been available for a long time, you know, let alone what, you know, we're talking about today with AI that's impacting, you know, the global markets.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about healthcare being a decade behind in that regard. Again, I think the IT spend that I see that is picked up is in some cases just a change in the balance of power, kind of in the C-suite, you could say, that a chief technology officer, chief information officer suddenly has the upper hand because of this need to have an AI strategy. And in that case, a lot of the spending has been on things, programs that could have been green-lighted a few years ago. As it relates to healthcare, it seems that the cost pressures, the need to generate productivity growth, this seems to loom very large, you know, as we think about the potential for crowding out in our, you know, national health expenditures, the joke about, again, consuming the entirety of the economy. What are you seeing there? Are there opportunities as an investor to acquire businesses, kind of streamline these operations, accelerate technological adoption, and deliver high returns and in a way that actually improves system-wide efficiency?
Here at Carlyle, we've always had an investment mantra within healthcare, which simply states, be part of the solution, not part of the problem. We know that at almost 20% of US GDP that our healthcare system can do more, maybe even with less. So we look for businesses that reduce costs in the system while also looking to improve the quality of healthcare delivery and improving the access for patients to the healthcare system. And these continue to be issues for different people, different regions across the United States. But, you know, in our view, when you win on those dimensions, cost, quality, access, you know, we believe that's a winning formula over the long run. But it's also important to remember, like you mentioned, you know, healthcare is a highly regulated sector, and it comes with, you know, specific risks and opportunities that come along with that. And so investors really need to spend, you know, their time really diligencing what those opportunities and risks are, and why we think a dedicated kind of sector team like we have here at Carlyle is an important way to be investing in that market in particular. And I just even think of 2025 as a great example. Almost all of the actions the U.S. administration put into place impacted our sector. NIH cuts potentially, FDA staffing reductions, the change in the global tariff regime, the impact to Medicaid from the one big, beautiful tax bill, and even more recently around, you know, the Medicare Advantage kind of rate environment. All of those things, you know, impact our market, and not necessarily in a positive way when you think about underlying dynamics. And yet, when we take a step back, we still believe that this is a high growth, a dynamic market that's going to lead to value creation over the long run when you focus on the things that we do, frankly, in every investment and every portfolio company that we'll invest behind, around revenue growth and margin improvement and bringing the best management teams to each individual situation. You know, those continue to be things we look for in healthcare as well.
When thinking about the healthcare sector, very often when you think about portfolio diversification, you're thinking about diversifying across sectors, you can construct a portfolio that's actually very well diversified, that's entirely in the healthcare sector. So when you think about the subsectors that you're interested in, you know, obviously you have some with significant government involvement, whether it's regulations or reimbursement rates, as you mentioned, but others, you know, where it is more purely technological or scientific innovation. How are you thinking today about, you know, relative allocations, or what are your favorite subsectors?
You know, Jason, it's a great question. It's a strategy question, you know, that our team thinks about almost every day. And then it's really, how do we execute that strategy? I would say our strategy has been pretty consistent for a decade here on the healthcare side. That being said, it's also an evolution at all times. When I look at where we've invested, where we've had success, it's really thinking about two of the very global healthcare markets rather than just a national or regional, you know, investment in a services business. And so we really spend a lot of time in the life sciences space. So think all things pharmaceuticals. It could be products. It could be services. We like the life sciences industry. It's large. It's about $1 trillion globally, and it's growing in the mid-single digits. And if you spend your time in the right areas, you can find opportunities growing in the high single digits or into the double digits, you know, really trying to find those areas of green shoots. So think about within life sciences, you know, the trend towards biologics or next modality types of drug therapeutics and gene therapy, cell therapy, as opposed to just the chemistry that's, you know, frankly, been around for a couple decades, if not longer. A second area of focus has really been within the broader med tech market. And this is a place of particular strength for our franchise where we've invested a significant amount of capital over the last decade. You know, again, this is a multi-hundred billion dollar plus market growing in mid-single digit to high single digit areas. And it can be quite diversified, again, across products and services. You mentioned Medline, and we can get into that more in a little bit. You know, but that's a great business that's both a service business and a products business within that space. And we've got a number of other examples as well. And so we like those global markets. You discover a drug, you create a medical product that works. While there's different regional things you'll have to think about, whether it's pricing or working with the government, generally you can leverage that technology or capability on a global basis. In addition to those global markets where we really like to spend our time, and when thinking about even US primarily based companies, is really in that healthcare IT sector. As mentioned, that technology adoption, in our view, creates a long-term trend to invest behind. And we're seeing that, frankly, you know, across the landscape, whether it's doctors adopting technology in their offices for workflow purposes or for patient engagement, whether it's the healthcare insurers using technology to provide more efficient administration workflows. So that technology adoption really is across the landscape. And so we really see that as being very interesting. Now, what I always think of is you kind of skip the landline evolution. You go right to cell phones. Will AI be that in some regards for healthcare? Those are things we continue to watch closely. But I would say those three areas, life sciences, med tech, and HCIT remain front and center for us. Whereas you wouldn't have seen in our portfolio over the last decade, you know, a lot of four-wall, heavily reimbursed kind of businesses in healthcare. You know, we don't own a lot of physician groups for that purpose or hospitals or things like that. And that's been purposeful for some of the reasons that you mentioned.
So let's talk about Medline. First, congratulations on the IPO. Quite an achievement. So what does this suggest to you about the trajectory of value creation in healthcare? You sort of hinted at that a moment ago. What are your key takeaways, I guess, from the appetite for this from investors for this large healthcare products and services business?
Yeah, well, Medline is a little bit of a back to basics type of investment. First of all, as you noted, it's a very large company, but it also happens to probably be the best company I've had a chance to partner with during my 20-year private equity career. The business quality is amazingly high. It plays in large and growing markets. Think of that as $300 billion on a global basis. And it has that differentiated business model of both services and products, which has allowed it to gain share steadily over many decades. And most importantly, the quality of the management team is absolutely exceptional. It wins in the marketplace with its customers because it can deliver the highest quality service at the lowest cost. And Medline's customers, you know, think about hospitals or those physician groups, you know, they don't work on huge margins. And so when you can save them cents on the dollar for the supplies they need on a daily basis while also providing that in a high quality customer first way, that's a winning formula.
And so obviously this is a very large company. When you were making the investment, you had to suspect that an IPO was going to be the exit. When you're evaluating deals and you have to think about what is the exit, where is the exit liquidity, what is the event, how do you feel about IPOs, the capital market risk? How did you get comfortable going into this investment with that?
Yeah, Jason, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, this was the largest healthcare private equity deal ever when we invested back in 2021 at $34 billion. And while there's maybe a handful of folks that could have afforded to buy Medline here now in 2025 with all cash, you know, that list is few and far between. And so, as you noted, we saw the IPO as the very likely exit, even when we were investing several years ago. You know, but ultimately, our conclusion was that investors would want to have access to Medline, you know, in almost any market environment. So this isn't about a high growth market environment or a more defensive play. This is really a company that investors want access to, you know, in our view, in almost any markets. And the reasons I say that are one, you know, while Medline has scale, you know, $27 billion of revenue, it also has continued to grow 10% annually, almost on an organic basis under our ownership. And so this is not a slow growth kind of, you know, only cash flow generative kind of investment thesis. This is really a business that's number one in its markets. It's got high growth potential, and it also has significant cash flow, almost $2 billion a year of annual cash flow, depending on how you define that metric. All of those things we think are exceptional, and both private and public investors would see value in that. And I do think as we went through the IPO process, you know, throughout the course of 2025 and ultimately brought that company to the market in December, I think we saw kind of how the story resonated with investors and were able to successfully price that IPO, as you noted, which was the largest, you know, healthcare IPO of all times, but also the largest IPO in 2025.
I'm wondering what else we can take away from this experience. There's a lot of talk in markets in the past about large buyout can be tough because it's tough to exit some of these larger investments. Now, empirically, that has not been the case over the last 3 years. You've seen more distributions, higher DPIs in large funds than mid-cap, smaller counterparts. But of course, there is capital markets risks very often in these large transactions. What do you think Medline, in your experience, tells us about the exit market and exit opportunities more broadly?
Yeah, first of all, Jason, I think you're right. You know, that's out there in the market where it's hard, you know, to exit companies in the public setting. But, you know, frankly, here at Carlyle, we haven't seen that. I think we've actually been, on a global basis, a sponsor that's accessed the IPO markets most successfully over the last 12, 18, 24 months. And we've got half a dozen examples, both here in the US and not just in healthcare, but in other industries like aerospace and defense as well, but also globally in India and in Japan. From our perspective as an institution, I think we've seen the IPO markets as a successful exit alternative for our companies. And again, in my view, it comes down to investing in the highest quality types of companies with great growth and durable growth with nice cash flow and margins. And that's the type of investing we've been doing, you know, frankly, for 40 years here, you know, at the firm. But I'd also say when we look at where those distributions are coming from, and again, we think we're playing, you know, more than our part here at Carlyle in terms of distributing cash back to our investors, we're frankly seeing exits to financial sponsors, as well as to strategic buyers, really being open exit alternatives. And when you kind of look at where our exits are coming, it's pretty equal across the IPO markets or those different buyer universes. And so again, my view, a lot of it comes down to the quality of the business, the quality of the management team, the ability to drive revenue and earnings growth. And we're seeing that really across our portfolio. And because of that, we're able to then exit what we think are strong returns for, you know, each one of these individual companies that we bring to market.
Well, Bobby, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. I really appreciate it, Jason. Thank you.
And congratulations again on that record-setting IPO. As always, thanks for listening. And I hope you'll join us for next month's episode of Insights and Indicators.